Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 23rd of March 2020, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish. We're delighted to be joined by David Scott, bringing us northern exposure from north of the border. Are you 3 feet away from me?
Possibly, maybe.
Yes, we're about as far away from each other as we can get here in the studio. Naturally, we want to follow government advice.
Well, let's just have a brief look at the latest statistics. 350,646 cases worldwide of COVID-19. Deaths are up to 15,317, and recoveries up to over the 100,000 mark. So that's 100,354. There are still 234,975 active cases. Of those, 223,727 are classed as mild, and 11,248 are classed as serious or critical. Now, today is a special day in the Houses of Parliament because the emergency coronavirus bill is going through. So if we remember, this is all about containing and slowing the virus, easing legislative and regulatory requirements, enhancing capacity and the flexible deployment of staff across essential services, managing the deceased in a dignified way, and supporting and protecting the public to do the right thing and follow public health advice. It's that last one that's very 1984-like language, but anyway. So as we were pointing out on Friday, this bill has an expiry. And the bill says this act expires at the end of the period of 2 years, beginning with the day on which it was passed. And then the next clause basically says, except Section 1, Section 2, Section 4, Section 5, Sections 10, 11, 12, Section 16, Section 18, Section 20, 57 to 66, 68 to 70, and so it goes on. So lots of parts of this bill do not expire at the end of the 2 year period. Now, this is this issue of the duration of the act is something which is going to be a key and probably the only matter of debate today. Now, just to make sure that we understand what this act is saying, it's potentially going to allow police to detain suspects, people that are suspected of carrying the virus, for screening and quarantine, also to restrict travel, various emergency measures to help the NHS, apparently, including easier certification of death, suspension of democracy because no elections would be taking place while this bill is enacted. Just one doctor's opinion rather than two, as we mentioned, would allow someone to be detained and treated for mental health disorder. Then the greater use of video and audio links in courts. And what the bill says is that judges can take part in video links, but with video links, but juries can't. So as a result of that, actually, and maybe this will be somehow included in the bill, the Lord Chief Justice today has said that no new trials are going to start, and that this is jury trials, and that ongoing trials will be paused while there are arrangements put in place so that juries can take part safely. I'm not clear at this point what that means. And then getting back to the bill, then they also say that there would be the temporary appointment of judicial commissioners who authorise warrants under anti-terror laws should there be a shortage. I'm not clear whether that means a shortage of warrants or a shortage of judicial commissioners, but anyway, there you go. So, as I say, this issue of the sunsetting of this bill is going to be the key issue in Parliament today, probably. And so there's a cross-party amendment has gone in, suggesting that the text of the Act changes to this Act expires at the end of the period of 6 months, beginning with the date on which it is passed, subject to subsection 1A. And subsection 1A says that the Secretary of State may, by regulations, provide for this Act or specified provisions to continue to have effect for an addition of period of not exceeding 6 months. But there's a caveat on that as well, because it says regulations under subsection 1A shall be made by statutory instrument and may not be made unless a draft has been laid before and approved by resolution of each House of Parliament. So David, there seems to be some effort within the House of Commons, at least, to roll back the 2 year aspect of this, because all kinds of ills could be done within 2 years, restricted to 6 months. But the key point here is that all those sections of the bill which which the sunset clause doesn't apply to, those are still there. So apparently there is no sunsetting for large parts of this bill.
This is true. The issues to do with the mental health provision in section of people under the Mental Health Act is particularly concerning for anyone who's been campaigning in areas such as those we have and familiar with, for example, the Holly Gregg and Anne Gregg story and the role that the mental health laws and their abuse played in that particular scenario. There's also the effect this will have on the public. Things are not going to be the same. Don't know which way this is going to go, or is the public going to become less easy to fool, less obedient, or is this going to condition the public to accept yet more assaults on their freedoms and ancient liberties and do so cowed by fear? Time will tell.
Well, that is a good question, because Boris today, well, he didn't say this, you will need to show your papers, but basically this is what is reports in various newspapers this morning suggesting that there's going to be a cabinet revolt unless he basically accepts to a European style shutdown. So ID being having to be shown to leave the house, non-essential shops closing, police on patrol for anyone found in a group. And then Matt Hancock this morning saying that he expected a decision on just how draconian things were going to get to take place very soon, that nothing's off the table. He suggested that the situation could become very like in Italy and France, where basically if you want to go out in public, you've got to fill in a form and ask for permission. And the police are on patrol to hand out fines if necessary. So in addition, the government now is suspended. David, this maybe comes on a little bit to the economic side, but which we'll be talking about later. But the government has suspended rail franchises this morning to in order to try to maintain services, because operators claiming that they're facing collapse and that they are they're warning Britons apparently not to head over to campsites or to their holiday homes, because that's not essential traffic travel. Sorry. And of course, one of the things that Boris was saying over the weekend was that, you know, basically people in Britain have a choice. They can either take the advice and do it voluntarily, or he will basically force people to comply. I'm not quite sure what the difference is between those two positions.
Well, I mean, this is—it's remarkable. I mean, we are British. This is Britain. This is the last bastion of liberty. We're not the continent. And how long did this government stand against it? 2 days, three maybe, and then they just slowly collapsed. And now it seems that any time that Boris suggests anything that might be reasonable and not totalitarian, there's a threat of a cabinet rebellion to have this overthrown. What's happening, and of course there's no opposition, because the opposition, being the Labour Party, want even more. Their cry is it's not enough.
Yeah, David, I think I've got to say that your description from a few months back, that the big problem was we had a government of occupation, is now really very appropriate. We couldn't put it any better. Who exactly is the government at the moment? We can't really be sure. We know the Cabinet Office is doing as it pleases. We've got all of the links with the big media companies, the web-based companies, Google, Facebook, etc. And you've got the banking industry dictating terms. This is a government of occupation. There's no question of it.
Well, speaking of the banking industry dictating terms, here's the UK column from the 16th of March, and we were pointing out the Bank of England, the fact that the Bank of England had reduced interest rates by 0.5% and were switching on the money printing presses once again. So that was the 16th of March, and the Bank of England website saying 0.25% is the current bank rate. But David, that seems to have changed today. So I didn't hear any announcement of that.
It was rather quiet, but yes, here we have the current bank rate is now 0.1%. Quantitative easing has shot up to $645 billion. The small bond purchase scheme has been dropped. Obviously, there's much more by way of loans being pumped into the private sector and loan guarantees. But the inflation target still remains 2%. with almost a little comedy kicking at the end there. But yes, 645 billion. The money printing is going, and we know where that will lead.
Yes. Okay. So what's happening then with HMRC?
Now this is very interesting because HMRC have announced, it's not even complete yet, but this is what's on their website today, the support for businesses. Now, one of these I've highlighted there in red is deferring VAT and income tax payments. So this is absolutely fundamental because VAT is 140 billion a year. Income tax is a third of all tax receipts. So that's 280 billion a year. You add these together, you get something close to 400 billion that's going to be deferred per annum. The companies will still owe the government this. This is half of all government revenue. Half. So what we're going to see is national debt is going to go through the roof, and that's going to be secured by all the businesses owing a huge amount of money in back taxes to the government. So every business will automatically be in hock to the government. Now, the businesses have been told to keep paying their staff. Don't pay the government, pay your staff, even though you're not able to trade because the government has shut the whole economy down. So the businesses will go through the money. They will then get out of this eventually, 6 months, 2 years, who knows how long down the line. And they'll be faced with this huge back tax demand. Now, one of the things I wonder is what conditions might be placed on that not being called in immediately. It will essentially put the government in a position of preferred creditor, and remember they'll change the rules, to every business in the country. So if we're looking at kind of secret nationalisation of everything, this would seem to be how it's being done.
David, just before we move on from economic matters, I noticed over the weekend that the Germans are talking about this having causing a contraction, this whole shutdown causing a contraction on their economy of 5% this year. This is something that I think, if I remember rightly, that's about 2.5 times the contraction they experienced following the 2008 financial crash. People can't underestimate what effect this is going to have on national economies. I haven't seen any similar figure for the UK yet. But what are your thoughts on that? Because I don't think people really quite understand the consequences yet.
Well, one of my thoughts is who's actually running the show here? Because these are decisions that have been made to close down the economy, to contract the economy by, well, 5% sounds a bit optimistic to me. We know in the past that whenever that's happened, we've seen huge amounts of deprivation. We've seen things like suicide rates go up. We've seen the health of the nation decline. The emotional stress that people are under alone is extremely harmful. And who's decided that this is the best way to offset this virus? It seems that we're being led by people who don't have the ability to think independently, who themselves have been led by medical advice, which is, at the very least, and we'll come to this, highly questionable.
Yes, okay.
Well, perhaps we can come in at a slightly different angle and have a look at sort of medical advice, but the main subject is protection for NHS staff. And we got interested in this, of course, because there are indications that NHS staff are greatly at risk of the virus, and a number of them have been contracting the virus. But how many? Before we get there, let's just have a look at what the NHS is worried about, because they've been saying that they haven't got the right equipment. So a doctor telling the BBC apparently that frontline healthcare workers felt like cannon fodder as they do not have access to equipment such as face masks. There was also concerns that not enough of them are being tested. Of course, once they're tested and it's known that they've got the virus, then they can receive appropriate care, but it would appear that they're not being tested. But Boris Johnson has said that the UK has stockpiles of personal protective equipment. Well, do we? We've got a doctor here, Samantha Batt-Rawdon from the lobbying group, the Doctors Association. She said she'd heard from doctors who've not got access to that protective equipment. and the doctors are worried about their likelihood of contracting the virus and then spreading it to patients. Well, this is a bit of reverse engineering, Mike, and that would be exceptionally dangerous. And we've got another one, a Dr. Frances Mayer in Scotland, saying that she still didn't have the personal protective equipment that we require to keep us safe. But the situation seems to get more interesting, because if we take a local newspaper, Nottinghamshire Live, they're talking about the armed forces being brought in to help get supplies to the NHS front line. And we can perhaps ask a question there, Mike. What protection are the armed forces going to get from contracting coronavirus? The American armed forces have already gone to digital recruiting in order to try and stop the spread. That's a fascinating way of dealing with things. But could it be that we're bringing in Britain's very, very small armed forces into a high-risk situation close to the NHS? Well, we had a look for some NHS advice on this. We can't really find very much. This is one document where the NHS is saying that they need to preserve and protect the health, safety and well-being of staff, because that's critical to dealing with the outbreak. That sounds pretty sensible. But the BBC is a little bit more interesting, because they've got this article posted, "Do face masks actually work?" And this is a lady doctor talking about the fact that really they don't. So it's Dr. Young here from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And she's saying that the virus isn't floating around in the air, so it's not protecting me against anything because it's not there. What she actually says is that it's on your hands and what you touch, although she does admit that people working in close proximity with people who have the virus would be obliged, or it's advantageous, to wear the face mask. But this is her basic comment.
Right. Would it not be sort of common sense to say that if you're wearing a face mask and you cough, then the amount of virus that you distribute around the place would be significantly less?
Well, this is where it gets interesting, Mike, because with all this expertise, we don't seem to have a clear picture of what is going on. And this is one of the comments this lady says: the vast majority of people are not susceptible to getting a severe infection. So perhaps we can ask, why the panic? So fully qualified person. But we did our own work to see if we could find out how many NHS staff had been infected. So this was an email we sent out on the 17th of March, and we sent it to Public Health England. This seemed the logical place for the statistics about how many people in the NHS, full-time and part-time staff, had got coronavirus. But we got a very quick reply. This is not a, this is a question for National Health England. It's not for Public Health England. So we were told to go elsewhere. Well, we did that, and so we got in contact with NHS England and asked them the same question: can you give us the data for how many NHS staff have been infected? And oh dear, they didn't want to tell us. "Hi, Brian, we don't hold this data. All inquiries relating to case numbers being handled by the Department for Health and Social Care." And so we had a look at their website this morning. There are lines of media numbers, at least 20 lines. We started calling those numbers, including the on-duty officer. Nobody wanted to answer. So it appears that either they're all in a very big meeting or else they're at home. We know some of them are at home, but there was nobody who appears to hold this critical data. So we've now sent in another email, and we're asking what information they hold. But remarkable that here we are, the key and most vulnerable workers are people in the NHS, and yet the three major agencies don't seem to hold any data on what the risks and what the statistics are for coronavirus infection within NHS workers. David, we don't have to make this up, because it's now getting very obvious that something is badly wrong here. Public Health England doesn't know how many NHS people have been infected. I don't believe this. I believe that this is deceit. But why?
Indeed, and the whole policy regarding the health service seems to be, well, we must protect the health service. Is it not meant to be the other way around? Right? Is the health service not there to protect the population? Is that not their function? No, we must protect the health service. And the limitations of the health service, or the perceived limitations of them, seem to be one of the main drivers of all of the restrictions that's closing down the economy with untold damage.
Absolutely, but David, we've got survivors, designated survivors.
Oh, this is just now. There's been a lot of the wacky and the funny about this since its very start. But this is the Times from Sunday. Downing Street has drawn up a quote designated survivor end quote plan. Hopefully that's black humour that someone's put in there somewhere in Downing Street. Let's hope so. To ensure the continuity of government. Continuity of government is a very dark concept. Continuity of government means when everything breaks down, there'll be a man in a gun with a gun telling you what to do. That's what continuity of government means. They continue anyway. That if Boris Johnson or his top aides fall sick, Dominic Raab, the Foreign Secretary, who's also the First Secretary of State, will stand in for the Prime Minister if he contracts coronavirus. But the decision has unleashed acidic exchanges amongst ministers jostling to be next in line. So we see that we don't have the line of succession sorted out here. And I was thinking, this rings a bell. I remember this from my youth somewhere. There was some programme on the BBC, some fictional drama. So I Googled it, and sure enough, there was. It was called The Survivors, post-apocalyptic television drama from the BBC. This is back in 1975, when these things were drama and fiction and not news. Now, I particularly enjoyed the fact that the plot involved the plight of a group of people who survived an apocalyptic plague pandemic, which was accidentally released by a Chinese scientist and quickly spread across the world via air travel. Does this not sound vaguely familiar, gentlemen?
Well, I hope you're not trying to suggest that the BBC was predicting this, but if we just say on a coincidence basis that we have had a number of predictions, you simply say something is going on, because on purely statistical basis, the odds against these things happening are so enormous. Something else is going on, isn't it?
Well, what, David, what's going on in Scotland? That's the question.
Fascism is the answer. Now, here we have the Alan Smith MP. Now, we covered him a few weeks ago because he wanted to know someone's name, and he told the person they were on a list. Because they were troublesome and they weren't asking the right questions, so their name had gone on the list. Well, here he is again, and he's threatening the people in various ways. He's saying that representing a big part of rural Scotland and part of the National Park, I say this in all sincerity, the Daily Mail can F star 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 off. I don't know if he should be using stars in that way. It doesn't seem very MP-like, but there we go. Please stay at home. Our community is not your bolt hole. This is not a holiday opportunity. Take it seriously. And then a couple of days later, he says, folks, road closures and checkpoints, so we're going to have, show me your papers, will take up a lot of personnel, but are inevitable. The checkpoints are inevitable. If you do not follow advice, go home now, stay home. So here's Alan Smith pontificating and telling us all where we can go, what we can do, and we're going to have to get permission to leave our homes. And that is the totalitarian state unfurling itself before us without, in the mainstream media at least, hardly, we'll come to that in a moment, hardly a murmur of dissent.
But you're not allowed to take a ferry.
No, well, this is kind of the blockade. You know, this is not the U-boat menace, but we've got CalMac standing in for it. Here we see the Scottish Government, nice picture of Nicola Sturgeon there. From now on, ferries will be for those who live on our islands and who have a need to travel for essential supplies or business, nothing else. So don't think that you can go on a ferry. No, there'll be someone checking up on what you want. What is your business on that ferry, and making sure that you're thrown off if you do not satisfy the requirements. And the other little video, the other little bit here, the stay at home graphic. This is akin to the 1930s railway posters, which were encouraging people to get out and use the railways and see the country and how beautiful Britain was. And someone, I think in all seriousness, has modified this to say, stay at home, traveling to remote areas endangers life during a pandemic. So this is actually, people are so convinced by this, they're actually making up memes in favour of the government's restrictions on normal life. It just shows you how easily fooled some people are.
Well, is Nicola getting the right kind of advice?
Well, on the subject of easily fooled, here we have Nicola, a nice video, a nice picture here. I like the black and white shot. It's reminiscent of the 40s. There's Nicola standing there with resolution. See, her jaw is clamped shut in steely determination. It's almost Führer-esque, actually. It's very good. And there's just being advised by the chief medical advisor and someone else sitting there. All women, of course, so we're not doing gender balance now. It's far too important for that. And the chief medical officer was interviewed in a beautiful piece of interview when someone questioned her about whether we had enough respirators in Scotland, because she just predicted this huge increase in cases. And when questioned about number of respirators, she said, well, almost all of the cases will be mild, you know. So it went from alarmism to reassurance in one wonderful moment, as soon as their actual performance was questioned. This just doesn't sit well. It doesn't seem right. Mm.
Did you have a thought?
Well, I think it's extremely dangerous, is my opinion. And it's so well orchestrated. But we're just seeing our constitutional protections and liberties absolutely ripped apart. But I'm not quite as pessimistic as you and what people think, David, because a straw poll over the weekend, some very establishment figures were saying to me, my goodness, I don't know what's going on. Medical friends are saying this is a lot of nonsense. And people starting really to question what they're being told. But also you can feel a little bit of fear in people. They don't really believe some of it. They're beginning to get a bit twitched. I think it's part of the waking up process.
Well, David, Peter Hitchens had a very interesting article over the weekend on his blog on the Mail. And I thought it was interesting that the Mail felt the need to say underneath the headline there, our columnist is renowned for independent thinking. It will enrage many, but here he offers a highly controversial personal view.
Yes, can you see the speed at which they're backing away from Peter Hitchens and leaving him on his own? Individual view, nothing to do with us. It was an excellent article. One of the things he writes here is that, and then there is the Johnson government's stumbling retreat from reason into fear. At first, Mr. Johnson was true to himself and resisted wild demands to close down the country, but bit by bit he gave in. That's exactly right. That's what happened. He writes, he said, and what can one say to this? In a pungent letter to the Times last week, a leading vet, Dick Sibley, cast doubt on the brilliance of the Imperial College scientists, saying that his heart sank when he learned they were advising the government, calling them a team of doom mongers. He said the advice on the 2001 foot and mouth outbreak led to what I believe to be the unnecessary slaughter of millions of healthy cattle and sheep until they were overruled by the then chief scientific advisor, Sir David King. So that's very interesting that the Imperial College has been called into question at that point. And I'll just read the last paragraph from Peter Hitchens' piece. He says, this is our future, and if I do not lift up my voice to speak for it now, even if I do it quite alone, I should consider that I was not worthy to call myself English or British or a journalist, and that my parents' generation had wasted their time saving freedom and prosperity, which they handed on to me after a long and cruel struggle whose privations and griefs we can barely imagine. Yes, well, I agree wholeheartedly with that.
He was talking about Imperial College, and you have this from them, and the headline on it is Impact of Non-Pharmaceutical Interventions to Reduce COVID-19 Mortality and Healthcare Demand.
Yes, this is well worth people looking out. They're talking about interventions that go on up to 2 years. They admit that this is completely unprecedented and have no idea if it will work, they have no idea how people will respond. But the most striking thing is the little coloured table there. Under the subject do nothing, the death toll they're predicting is something ranging, this is for Britain alone, 410,000 to 550,000, which is 2 to 2.5 times worse than the Spanish flu. This is nonsense. There is no evidence at all that it's anything like as bad as that. Nowhere close. And where did they get it from? A computer simulation. So you can put information in and you get information out. This is what Alfred North Whitehead coined the fallacy of misplaced concreteness, which is confusing a computer model with the reality it purports to describe. This is the mistake they've made. And just as in the foot-mouth outbreak, I think here they're being wildly pessimistic and we're all going to suffer the consequences.
Absolutely. So we leave it to a UK column member, supporter and occasional contributor. He said on Twitter, weakening resistance to dictatorship seems to be the main effect.
Yes, I thought that put it beautifully and briefly. That seems to be where we're at. And of course, not doing that, not succumbing to that weakening effect is our calling, gentlemen.
Yes, indeed. Okay, well, if you like what the UK Column does and you would like to support us, then please head over to ukcolumn.org/community. There are options for supporting us there and your help would be much appreciated, much needed. Now, I wanted to briefly highlight this article in The Guardian. The headline is, "We're in serious trouble, colon, the other crisis, our food supply." This is by Jay Rayner. It's an interview. With a very senior expert in the area of our capability to feed ourselves. Now, many people will read this and will be a little bit cynical because it's, of course, involves interviewing someone who's written a book and the book's for sale on the Guardian website. But nonetheless, the question is this a real problem that we're facing? Or is it something that perhaps The Guardian has been pushing for quite a long time? So this was The Guardian back in 2018. UK could run out of food a year from now with no deal Brexit, NFU warned. So they were pushing this idea of food crisis in the UK for quite some time. But so let's look at this. Now, the fact of the matter is that the UK imports 48% of the total food consumed and the proportion that it imports is rising. So we are far from being food independent. Alongside that, then, we have this push by the government and by the government's advisors. This is a committee on climate change who call themselves independent and say that they give independent advice to government on building a low carbon economy and preparing for climate change. And of course, they've been pushing the notion of stopping eating meat and, you know, stopping farming basically completely. We need to turn our fields over to solar panels and other things. And of course, this was absolutely the message throughout the Brexit campaign. So here's Michael Gove. He was saying in 2018, as we leave the EU, we have an historic opportunity to deliver a farming policy that works for the whole industry. Well, what was the policy that he was talking about? This is basically it. 20% of the nation's farmland to be transformed over the next 30 years into landscapes designed to store carbon and cut emissions. Now, anybody that happens to listen to the BBC's radio propaganda outlet for the farming industry, which is called The Archers, will know that they have been pushing rewilding wild farm meadows and so on. This is something that Michael Gove was absolutely doing all through the Brexit process, because as we come out of the common agricultural policy and all that money comes back into the UK, we won't be using that money to reinvigorate our farming industry. We're going to use that money to promote the idea of public goods. And a public good is a path, a walk, it's a walk through the trees or a wildflower meadow or something like this. Now, ironically enough, even the people that are campaigning for wildflower meadows are making the point that if you don't stir up the soil, if you don't have cattle and ploughing and so on, that actually you're going to lose your biodiversity as a result. So although they're all for the idea of wildflower meadows, they're not arguing that farming should stop in this country. Then, of course, we've got this issue, which is the flooding. We've had serious flooding this year. And that is having, it is already having a massive impact on our capability to grow food this year. Just to remind everybody, of course, one of the reasons that many people argue that we are suffering from the level of flooding that we have been this year and the last couple of years is because of the European Water Framework Directive, which was passed, put on the UK statute books by Tony Blair in 2000. Prior to that directive becoming UK law, rivers and were dredged by hand. People from the local water boards dredged the rivers, and then they would dig out the silt and pile it on the banks. But unfortunately, that's not allowed under the water, the European Water Framework Directive. And in fact, any sand and gravel that is removed from rivers is now classed as hazardous or controlled waste and can't be deposited to raise the riverbanks. So we have changed our land management procedures. We are changing our policy with respect to farming, and we are increasingly unable to feed ourselves. So just coming back to the Guardian article and asking the question, are they being accurate when they suggest that we're in serious trouble? David, I would say that we probably are in serious trouble, but this is a policy decision. Of course, policy decisions can be reversed, but that requires pressure from the public.
Yes, but the if we're in a situation where the normal free market exchange is being clamped down and essentially snuffed out, which it is, that's going to have huge ramifications to all aspects of the economy, not least of which would be food supply. And let's remember that the terrible Ethiopian famine that we all remember Bob Geldof slamming the table about, that came about after a collectivization of the farms and a political intervention in farming in Ethiopia. It wasn't just the lack of rainfall, it was the political introduction of communism that killed the free market. Now, what we're doing to the economy here, they've no idea the implications of this. No one can know. It's never been tried before, at least in this country. And how many links in the complex supply chain will be destroyed during this government overreaction to the COVID-19 virus? Who knows? What sort of condition will we be in 6 months from now to feed ourselves? Who knows?
Indeed. The only government business that's going to be done today, tomorrow and Wednesday is the coronavirus emergency legislation. There is one other Act of Parliament which will be discussed later in the week and will make further progress, and that's the extradition provisional arrest bill, which is, of course, the European arrest warrant on steroids. And so that is heading on through. This was originally entered into the programme by Baroness Williams of Trafford. So although it began in the House of Lords, it is a government bill, so it will continue to pass. And this was announced in the Queen's speech in December. Basically, it's there to deal with the potential short-term removal of the UK from the European arrest warrant because of Brexit. But of course, it doesn't end with EU countries, because if we remember what this is about, it says it amends Part 2 of the Extradition Act 2003 to create a new power of arrest for extradition purposes. Part 2 deals with the extradition to territories which are not EU member states, but with which the UK has a formal extradition agreement. The new power of arrest will enable law enforcement officers to arrest individuals without a warrant of arrest from a UK court in certain cases. And the new power will only apply where the request for an individual's arrest for extradition purposes, which could, for example, take the form of an Interpol red notice, has been certified as having been issued by a specific country, one of the listed countries to which the arrest power applies in relation to a serious offence. So that's all right then. It doesn't need a warrant or any kind of judicial process here. In the event that the UK is unable to use the European arrest warrant, this bill could be used to designate EU countries to mitigate the loss of immediate power of arrest currently provided by the European arrest warrant. But basically what this boils down to is it's very similar to the European arrest warrant, except that at least with the European arrest warrant, there's still some kind of hearing takes place in this country. In this case, in some cases, warrants will not be required, but it extends that power of arrest and extradition to a much broader range of countries than just the EU. So, David, you should be feeling much more comfortable now.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, we're seeing more and more of our ancient rights and freedoms squashed, and what's coming in its place is state-run. Everything of the state, nothing outside the state, nothing above the state, so words like that, was how Mussolini described it. That's what we're seeing again.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, if you are concerned about the propaganda coming out of the BBC, and of course the BBC has got to be the lead in the propaganda on coronavirus in UK, certainly, but probably, possibly worldwide, you're not going to get much joy from Ofcom. And a little while ago, we were tackling Ofcom, questions of transparency and accountability connected to the BBC. We asked them the following questions. Now, I've simplified these questions. We are going to be showing audiences the detail in subsequent news programmes, but they gave us a reply which was headed classification confidential. I'm not sure why that was, and we've asked them. We asked why some board members declared interests and others didn't. We also pointed out that if one board member attending a meeting discussing the BBC did not take part in discussions due to their family BBC connections, why were others present similarly connected with the BBC allowed to speak? So classic case of double standards. And question four, how was the Ofcom content board allowed to continue formal deliberations when 7 out of 10 members present have declared personal BBC interests, including pensions? And that Ofcom content board was sitting to discuss matters to do with the BBC. And the last one I'll throw in is that we know that certain junior Ofcom employees were also present in the particular board meeting we were interested in. Apparently they were there to answer questions which more senior Ofcom members might not be able to answer themselves. And we've asked who these junior people are, because they're anonymous at the moment. Why would we want to tackle Ofcom over the BBC? Well, of course, the BBC, amongst others, bigs up the thoughts of Chairman Boris on coronavirus. Doesn't do really much factual questioning of what Boris is saying. But the BBC's got some really quality advice, which I spotted over the weekend. Let's have a look at who the BBC thinks is the right man to advise the public. And it's this gentleman called Sykes, and he's a drill rapper, and he's spreading awareness, apparently, Mike. Well, let's have a look at drill music. I had to check up on this a bit, but it's a style of trap music that originated from the south side of Chicago in the 2010s. It's defined by its dark, violent, nihilistic lyrical content and ominous trap-influenced beats. Well, if you don't know what the trap bit is, that this is connected with illegal drugs. So we've got the BBC cruising on the back of coronavirus to promote dark, violent, nihilistic music and illegal drugs. What does this young man have to say? We need to pay attention to him, of course. Well, he says that changes to his daily life, that coronavirus regulations might bring in, he wouldn't be able to watch football. This would be very hard for him. But he's also spreading the message that people should avoid hugging and shaking hands for now, at least for now. And one of the hardest things he's anticipating is not being able to see his friends. This is, he's not worried about the people who are suffering or perhaps sick of coronavirus. He's worried about his friends. But he's studying for a BTEC in performing arts, sport and business. He's really happy with the reaction to his rap, which is called Spreadin. And the BBC has been promoting that for him on BBC Extra on Snoochie Shy's show. Mark, you're laughing, but this is real. This is real BBC news. And he said he was gassed. And I think I know what that refers to. So there we are. And if you want a bit more of the BBC, here's Chris Morris, who's big in BBC Reality Check. And he's telling us what we've got to be careful of watching on alternative media. Basically, he's saying if it's not the BBC, it's fake. Well, the reality is, if it is the BBC, it's probably fake.
Well, that can't be right, Brian, because BBC News Labs has decided that they are going to provide the BBC staff with the explainer builder. This is an experiment in using a single source of truth for journalists creating explainers. So there you go. The single source of truth, of course, is the BBC. These are the types of things that they are putting. You're starting to see these embedded on many articles. And in fact, the three types of articles that they're extremely proud of are coronavirus articles, US primaries and election, and also climate change articles. So it's basically frequently asked questions which get embedded in the body of the text. They say that our thinking is that including all of these questions and stories will allow our audiences to easily find background information on long-running stories which they may not be familiar with. Initial analysis is promising and shows that readers are mostly clicking the questions that are chosen by the journalist in the embed. So no problem there. David, we can rely on the BBC with their explainers, and they are, after all, the single source of truth.
The single source of truth. You know, it's even implicit in the King James translation of the Bible that you're well read across a wide range of subjects in order to understand any given argument. But apparently the BBC is a higher power now. And they don't require any such hard work on behalf of their listeners and viewers.
Okay, well, we're right out of time, David. So just quickly on this then, what's the latest with Alex Salmond?
The jury's out. But the jury's been slightly depleted. Jury in Scotland's 15. We're down to 13. Two have gone for, quote, various reasons, end quote. But they still need a majority of the original jury. So we now need 8 of 13, as opposed to 8 of 15, to convict Alex on any of the 13 charges. One charge has been dropped, so he's been declared not guilty on one charge already. We will see what the verdicts will be.
Is there any indication of how it's gone for him?
It's very difficult to know. There was one very pro-nationalist citizen journalist who's a former diplomat, a former British diplomat who's got quite radical views on things like Syria and related matters. He went along, got himself in the public gallery, blogged about it, went back the next day and was told by the police that he was not being granted admission. And in fact, there is a possibility that there would be some action taken against him for contempt of court.
That would be Craig Murray, I presume.
Yes, that's Craig Murray. He was understandably very alarmed by this and asked what the alleged possible contempt was concerning. And no one could answer the question. So you couldn't even go to his blog and delete something if the court had deemed it inappropriate, because no one would tell him what it was. So that gives you an idea of sort of the febrile nature of the protection surrounding this. The actual court case seems to have gone pretty smoothly. There's been quite a robust defence put forward by Alex Salmond's team as well. And it's in the hands of the jury now. I wouldn't like to say which way it would go. I certainly wouldn't be surprised if it's an acquittal.
Yes.
From what I've seen in the press reports. But I wouldn't be much surprised if it was a conviction either. It's very difficult to know which way this will come.
Okay. And we're going to end with a little video clip. David, just introduce this for us.
Yes, this is from a club, a comedy club. And it's called Comedy Unleashed. They have comedians of all different political viewpoints and ideologies, and they allow them the freedom. They don't take sides, but they allow the comedians the freedom to say things that other clubs might not allow them to say. And this is part of one. We'll play the full thing later on in the UK Column News Extra. But this is a little extract from Dominic Frisby's song, Maybe, concerning a certain issue which has been in the news rather a lot lately.
Okay, thank you, David.
They said it's a coronavirus called COVID-19, a deadly global pandemic without a known vaccine. Dramatic action is required, no matter what the cost. for millions could lose their lives and trillions be lost. Another Spanish flu, a plague in all but name. All the same. Maybe the hype is worse than the disease. Do we really need to bring the world to its knees? Death does not await. Mortality rates are less than 300. Far greater harm comes from the alarm and from all the blunders. Life must go on, just knit it if you please.